Hello again, and welcome to This Week in the Ancient Near East, the podcast that takes archaeology exactly as seriously as it deserves. I'm Alex Jaffe, and I'm director of the Bob and Ray Institute of Archaeology at the University of Southern North Dakota at Hoople. Fortunately, I'm joined by two real academics from actual institutions, Professor J.P. Dussel of the University of Tennessee and Professor Rachel Hallett of the State University of New York at Purchase. We're coming to you from the Bob and Ray Institute's lush rooftop orchid garden slash studio here on the beautiful Hoople campus. Today we have a rare double feature. First, an actual listener visits our high-tech mobile studio and describes a visit a few years back to the looting tunnels dug by ISIS beneath the Assyrian city of Nineveh. I'm not sure which is more amazing, visiting Nineveh while fighting was still going on, or the fact that we have physical proof of a listener. Probably the first thing, but who can really say? Next, we turn our attention to a new and quite exemplary publication that describes plant remains recovered from two successive Philistine temples at the site of Tel Es-Safi, or Gat. We take our hats off to the team that sifted through lots and lots and lots of dirt to find thousands of samples from dozens of different species of plants that were burned or used to decorate these 10th and 9th century Philistine temples. Like the fruit of the chase tree, the garland chrysanthemum, and our old friend the bitter vetch. So what does it mean when archaeologists can determine the origins and seasonality of plants used in ritual contexts? Should the emphasis be on the local, the use of the environment for local practices, or on the comparative dimensions, in this case, the strong parallels between these Philistine practices with contemporary Greek temples in the Argolid? Well, obviously the emphasis should be on both. But it all raises some interesting questions like, what is the role of plants in creating or maintaining ethnicity? Do plants actually equal people? Who knows? All I know is I really like the sound of a chaste tree. Okay, well, here we are. Well, it's a very special day, actually, because literally out of the blue.
It's a special day because we're doing a mobile podcast from an undisclosed location.
I'm looking around. Everything looks very disclosed to me.
Some of us are in an
undisclosed. Yeah, you can speak for yourself.
I only do.
Okay, but the other thing that makes it special is that for reasons that are too convoluted to go into here, we actually have the listener, possibly. As a special guest.
Our first special guest.
It's going to be the first of many. It's going to be a new feature.
As long as we have stars.
We don't know that many people, though. So, say hi, Matt.
Hello, listeners. It is...
No, listener.
We only have one.
Loyal listener.
Yeah, well, he's talking to himself because it's kind of a self-reflexive thing.
Plural, me.
Yeah, reflexivity.
Well, hello, and or listeners. It is Matt here from Washington, D.C.
Supposed to be an undisclosed location.
Washington, D.C.
It's a big area.
Right.
District. It's a region. And
it's fascinating to meet you. We're glad that you listen. Why? Why would you want to do this? You have nothing better to do, apparently.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Well, he's training for a marathon, so he has lots of podcast time.
That's true. And I commute on every day. So, you know, I need to fill the time. And what better to fill the time with than listening to stories of the ancient Near East?
Tales of the unexpected.
Exactly. I mean, you never know what you're going to get. And that's the beauty of it.
Good answer.
You make a good point that way. But why archaeology? Why would you want to listen to something so arcane and out there? Do you have any interest particularly Any background? Why?
No real background.
Like we're like doing market research on you. So just
have you ever been to the Near East?
I have been to the Near East many times. So I can talk a little bit about being in Iraq, went to Nineveh. So that was, you know, brought it to life in many in many ways for me. And
it to death in many ways to other people, but yes.
That's true.
Right.
Well, it's yeah.
Ongoing.
Many, many layers of life and death were included in the journey. But
poetic, really.
Yeah. Ancient Near East for you.
Yeah.
And the modern Near East.
Modern, right.
Modern Middle East.
Well, nothing ever really changes there.
So what was the most interesting thing you saw in Nineveh?
Well, when I was there, it was 2017. So there were the...
BCE or CE?
CE.
Okay.
Not that.
So 2017 would have been the end of the Ur III dynasty.
And
an exciting time to be in.
It was a time of change, I'll put it that way. And okay. There were... at the time, there was the fighting to liberate the city of Mosul from ISIS. So when I was there, it was right in the middle of that battle, I suppose you could say. It was they had liberated the news part of the city on the eastern bank, and they had yet to go in and begin liberating the western side of the city. And so when we were there, we were able to go in. I was working for an NGO. We were able to go in to the eastern side, to the shrine to Jonah. And then obviously underneath Jonah, there were these tunnels that ISIS had dug into the mountain for various reasons. And we were able to go into those tunnels and see the winged bull and the cuneiform wall inscriptions. I mean, I'm sure you could correct me on this, but you know, the engravings and all of this, just in these sort of hand dug mud tunnels underneath Mosul, which was quite an experience.
And you live to tell about it.
That's the most exciting part. I was about to say.
Right.
That's true.
I mean, do you know any archaeologists? Really?
I know JP.
No, we're talking about real archaeologists.
The reason I knew or was able to go down into the tunnels was because we had a connect. My NGO, the director of my NGO, knew. An official, I guess you could say, in the Nineveh Directorate of Archaeology or Antiquities.
Mm-hmm.
And she was able to kind of just make it happen.
Grease the wheels.
Yeah. Ooh. I mean, the way you got into it, the whole shrine had been detonated. I mean, the ISIS had destroyed the whole thing. So you go up, you went up the little mound, the mountain, and you go past a bunch of different checkpoints, all controlled by like different groups. You get to the top and it's just ruins. It's just completely devastated. And ISIS had put IEDs all throughout the ruins and they were still trying to clear those out. So you basically meet up with, it's like me and this woman who's the official and an archaeologist from Mosul University. I forget his name, but he was involved in like the original excavation in the 70s. And we get up to the top. And we meet this guy who's a, you know, he's just a soldier with one of the various units that's associated with this site. And we meet up with him and he's just, okay, let's go. And he's, you know, we have to walk in a single file line to weave in and out of whatever path they've cleared of explosives and ordnance. And you can hear the fighting going on because it's not that far away. So you hear it and you feel the, you know, concussions from airstrikes and everything going on just a few miles away across the river. And you wind up in this like small, like rat hole, basically, and you just kind of drop down and then there you are like in these tunnels. It's pretty wild.
You drop down the wrong rat hole and who knows who you'll find.
You'll find ISIS. You'll find ISIS. I mean, it was crazy to get down there because obviously the sound, once you're down underground, you don't hear anything anymore. So it's just like silent and, it smells awful because people were living down there. And they used, I guess, slave labor to dig it out. And so, you could really sort of get lost in that little world down there. But
and that didn't turn you off to archaeology and for all.
No, because once you get through that,
it's piqued your interest.
Yeah, once you get through those initial, like, very narrow single file tunnels, it kind of opens up into these like relatively cavernous rooms, and you see the bull and you see the temple inscriptions, and it's, you know, pitch black, so you have a little flashlight, and it's
so your experience is sort of like a metaphor for archaeology as a whole, exaggerated, you might say. There's some unpleasantness, some nastiness.
Exactly.
Fighting,
and then there's
death,
discovery, and
a whole, and then there's discovery, and that makes it all good.
But the more important thing is the self-discovery, right?
Well, discover and the friends things, we meet along the way.
Right, and then you discover what it is about you that draws you to these things.
Right.
The other important thing is archaeology in wartime and how these sites are manipulated and often destroyed. And
kinetically, so. Straight up and down.
Well, the interesting part about all of this was it hadn't really been touched. I mean, ISIS had dug out these tunnels to, I guess, avoid airstrikes, but they hadn't touched any of the, like, carvings or the wall, like cuneiform or the bull or anything, probably because they couldn't get it out of there. Yeah. They were selling everything that they could
find. It's hard to move that kind of loot.
Exactly. So it was really, it was pristine. I mean, as far as I could tell, I mean, I'm not a trained anything, but it looked very pristine. There were carvings that, at least at the times, the people I was with were saying that, you know, they were studying them. They hadn't seen carvings like that in that region before, so it was a very, like, valuable site for them. It's quite.
So out of bad things, a little bit of good can come, maybe, depending on, you know, which end of the AK-47,
which end of the stick you're on.
Yeah.
All right. Do we have a lightning
round? Should we do a lightning round?
Yeah, let's do a lightning round.
It doesn't fully conjoin.
Okay, that's all right.
I mean, it's sort of.
Let's hear it.
What's the strangest plant that you have in your house?
Interesting.
I don't really have too many strange plants.
Petunias.
That's strange. Well, strange. Or
strange as in non-local, unusual, exotic.
Exotic.
These are very presentist, you know, Western kind of, I don't know.
I bought some unusual succulents in the fall, and one of them is called a hobbit.
Okay, that's pretty unusual.
From the Shire.
Yeah.
Matt?
We have pretty basic plants in here. We have a money tree, spider plant.
Money tree. Wish I had a money tree.
Yeah,
we all wish.
I wish it grew money, but it just grows leaves.
Yeah. It's the cheap kind.
A couple of years ago, I had these things called chicks and hens that it's a great name. The name is much more exciting than the actual plant. But basically it would have a center thing, and then it would send off these little succulent shoots. So that I like the name. Yeah. Alex?
Well, I have two. One is a stapelia, which is a kind of succulent that's native to South Africa, to the Eastern Cape region. And it produces these intense bell-shaped flowers where the inside is so dark purple, and it smells like rotting flesh.
Nice.
Which is cool. Oh. But we also have a Ziziphus, crown of thorns.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
You have a long history with the Ziziphus. which I will not get into.
Which we won't get into. And I have that artifact, but fortunately there are no pictures.
Yes. Well, it was at night.
It was at night. But with that very, very clever segue, we can now begin to talk about the object du jour.
All right. Well, someone should introduce the article. Rachel?
Okay.
She just leapt right in.
Yeah.
Well, somebody,
you know, I don't want to do some kind of gender typing here, but.
Oh, no, we're more than 10 minutes in. I thought maybe we should. I agree. We should introduce the article.
In our next hour.
Right. So.
Well, this is a very specific article-driven podcast.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. We talk about very concrete things.
Always. So, yeah. So I like this article. I thought this article was really interesting. It is about the Philistine site of Gath. And
Telesafi,
thank you. And this is about the microarchaeology of plant remains. Now, usually I'm sort of, people who have listened or our listener knows that I'm negative.
Person who has listened.
The person who has listened might know that I'm negative about microarchaeology. And
I know.
Yes. However, this kind of just grabs you. I think they did interesting work and they said interesting things about the work. So basically, there are these two successive temples, one dating to the 10th century BC, that's the earlier one, and then the later one is about a century later, 9th century, and we know the end date, we know the destruction date of that temple. And
the destruction date is 830 BCE,
right?
Thanks to Hazael of Damascus.
And I believe it occurred at 8:30 a.m.
They did say, well, I don't want to get too far ahead, but they can tell what season it was.
Right. And that's one of the cool things about this article.
The whole thing was just fascinating.
Right.
Just,
and so basically, let me just finish. So they were, they analyzed the plant remains that came from the vicinities of these temples. And they learned a lot about what plant offerings, what vegetable offerings might have been given in these temples. And that told a lot.
Vegetative offerings?
Give me a better term. anyway, we learned a lot about the potential types of deities who might have been worshipped there.
And do we want to mention the lead author of this article,
Alex? Yeah, Alex, you do that.
Well, the article is called Plant-Related Philistine Ritual Practices at Biblical Gath, and it's in Nature Scientific Reports. And the lead author is Sue Fruman, and another of the authors is our old pal, Aaron Mayer, who was the director of the Telesafi project for many, 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 many years.
Since 830 BCE.
Yes. And this is really... I don't think you can say enough good things about the concept and the methodology and the execution and the whole.
The Gonza Megillah.
The whole Gonza Megillah. And it really, it raises for me some very fundamental questions, because for all these years, we've been talking about pots equaling people. And yes.
But for the Philistines, they're the poster child for pots equaling people.
Right, exactly. But and that's always been the question, like, oh, is it pots? Is it hybridity? Oh, they're not really pots. They're pots from here, and they have this kind of style. There's a little Cypriot. There's a little Southwestern Anatolian influences and blah, blah, blah. But really, I think it's one of the question has been wrong. It's not pots equal people, but... plants equaling people.
Oh, plants equaling
plants equal people? Or plants...
You didn't see that coming.
Interesting.
Plants equal deities.
I thought you were going to say contents equal people.
Well, I mean, I wanted the alliteration.
Right. Hmm. Right.
So yeah, they have 2,000 samples,
yep.
which is a lot, and there's 26 different species of different plants, and there's economic plants like pulses and wheat and stuff like that, but there's also common weeds like the like what are some of the weeds? My favorite was the poison darnel.
We don't need to get into the weeds, but
no, I just wanted to say the term poison darnel.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
You know, our old friend, the bitter vetch.
Yes. Well, right. It's good to see the bitter vetch not only making an appearance, but making an appearance that says something, as
right.
opposed to, you know, oh, we have bitter vetch, so we must have irrigation, and we must have, you know, early domestication and blah, blah, blah.
Right. Yeah. Well, so a lot of these plants were wild and some of them were domesticates.
Right.
Right. So they're taking these, they're taking all sorts of different plants, including weeds, including sort of these berries from the chaste tree. The
chaste tree.
And they're
that's
putting
one
them
of the most unusual ones. That's quite a find.
Right. Your Vitex agnus castus.
It rolls trippingly off the tongue.
Yeah.
And speaking of trippingly, there was some psychotropic drugs found or that, indications
right.
of.
Right.
Well, that's your bitter Darnell.
Right.
Exactly. Poison Darnell.
Poison Darnell meets the bitter vetch.
Right.
But the amazing thing to me is that these are, they're burning some plants.
Right.
They're using some as decorative items. They're not storing lots of boring wheat and emmer and barley and stuff like that. They're not making boring kinds of, you know, bread or cake and stuff, but it's ritual. It's decorative. And there's a very distinct seasonality that can be detected.
It's literally a little song, a little dance.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Right. There's seasonality and they're cleaning up. They're very tidy. So they're cleaning the areas after every ritual. And it really gives, one of the takeaways I had is it really gives a sense that these priests or whoever was administering the temple were active all year round, that it was a full-time all year round job, that these were not, you know, part of the community and they, you know, worked in the community and then they also officiated at rituals and things like that. But there was a lot of work going on. There was a lot to do.
Yeah. And you're saying that because these things are harvested at different times of year.
Yeah. And processed. It's harvesting, processing, you know, who knows, drying and storing and then putting it away, taking it out, cleaning the areas up. Yeah. It just, to me, it really sort of started to fill out the daily life of an officiant priest.
There's not a lot that goes on between January and March.
Well,
relatively less.
I don't know. The crown daisy and the cheeseweed both flower from February to May, and they are found in both temples.
Right, but the percentage of species that were harvested or in January through March is less. But things really take off in April through July or so.
Right. Or even later.
Yeah. August.
Well, into the fall.
The fall. Exactly.
Right. And that's why they say that the last destruction of the later temple took place late August or September of 830, I guess, because of the types of plant remains that were found at the very end.
Great.
Meaning they had time to do those last sacrifices before the destruction.
Yes, well, nothing would get in their way. Being good religious officiants, the world could be collapsing around them, but they're going to finish the ritual.
Right. And clearly the ritual was not to stop enemies coming in and destroying them. It was purely agricultural in nature.
Well, so there's a tremendous amount of really good, interesting work. But then there's also this ambiguity or this lack of precision in that maybe I'm jumping the gun. So let's talk a little bit about the relationship made in this article to the potential gods, goddesses that are in play, that are being evoked. And I thought that was a very nice piece of kind of sort of historical archaeology and, you know, comparative archaeology, looking at what plants are associated with gods and goddesses in adjacent areas, especially the Aegean.
Right. So, yeah, maybe one of us should point out, maybe I'll point out that the Philistines or the Peleset were one of these sea peoples who came from the regions of the Aegean and in Aegean terms, like in the Mycenaean period, and ended up settling on the southern coastal plain of Canaan. We have all these Philistine sites. So we kind of know the origin point of the people who became the Philistines.
But that hasn't stopped people from arguing until they're blue in the face for the last 100 years about whether they stopped over in Cyprus to go to Howard Johnson's for how long, or whether they come from, whether they're actually from Arzawa, the kingdom on the west coast of Anatolia.
Right. Or most recently, and the sort of the best work suggesting that they're from Crete.
Right.
So we still lack the kind of precision. I mean, we're in the Aegean world writ large, but I like the fact that they're identifying or at least relating possible cults and goddesses to the Philistines.
Yeah, exactly. So they're looking at later Greek cults, which are well known because Greek historians wrote tons about them. And they're from there relating them back to the Philistines.
Right. So there's a strong connection between these plants and sites in the Argolid.
Right.
Yeah.
And so presumably these Philistines, whoever they were, however hybrid they became.
Well, I've never heard that word said so slowly.
I say it with the special distinction that it deserves. They're still doing things the old way after 100, 200, 300-ish years of being settled in the southern Levant after the horrible collapse of 1177.
There is no collapse. It's all about regeneration. So some of the gods that are suggested include Hera, Artemis, Demeter, as you said, Alex, very mainstream, right?
Right.
I think that's a nice little piece of information that comes out. It obviously is an inference. Obviously, there's no direct data to connect it all, but it's just, sort of a inferring based on, as we said, later cults. So I thought that was really interesting. And I also think it's really interesting that the god that we always associate with the Philistines, Dagon, is, we don't have any connections with that. We don't know anything more about that particular god. And that's what I find most interesting. I really do like this article, but whenever we end up talking about cult and religion, we have some greater degree of resolution and information based on these plants, but we also speak in very broad generalities, right? These gods are associated with healing and,
fertility.
Right.
Fertility, everybody drink.
Exactly.
You're all right. You're both right. But I want to also say that Dagon is often associated with agriculture.
They all are.
Well, yes, that's true.
Associated with agriculture.
Isn't it better that Dagon is associated with agriculture than if he was associated with war?
There are no gods that are associated with library science.
It's so broad in general. They're all associated with agriculture because it's an agrarian society, and they have this very rich, diverse plant base with all of these plants going through different phases of, harvesting, growing,
right.
All of this. So it just fills up the calendar, A, and B, we don't have any more precision. These gods have many, many roles. And we associate, it doesn't really do anything on that score.
It gives us a very much more refined picture of local practices, local to the site and probably to the culture to some extent,
right?
The local use of natural resources in the landscape, particularly plants and seasonality, and this is a kind of intimate picture of what they're doing, what their lives daily, monthly, weekly looks like,
right?
Which we couldn't possibly have imagined before.
Exactly.
But we're
before
still
we're looking like, oh, the wheat grows, the wheat gets harvested, blah blah blah.
Right. But we're still lacking any precision regarding what these deities, who the deities are, and anything about them. And that's you know, it's like we haven't made any headway on that, which is fine.
Well, it's connecting the structure to the superstructure.
But we do know,
following that analogy, we do know more about the deities of Greece later. I mean,
we do.
We know a lot about them earlier too, in the Mycenaean period.
Right, these deities might be in play.
Right,
but again, they have so many, you know, agriculture and fertility and health, you know, any kind of health kind of thing with association with Asclepius, and that's like, you know, and even today, monotheistic traditions ascribe all of these things just to one god, but they're just, all of these are just basic human concerns.
Well, that's true. That's
right. And you know, we, as I said, we don't, I guess maybe we shouldn't expect to make any better understanding of all of this religion kind of stuff, because it is overly syncretistic and broad and general and ambiguous and vague when you get down to it.
But
I wanted to note, I'm sorry, just before,
go ahead.
Is that they drop in this very interesting thing and don't expand on it, which is fine, because they did so much, really so much service and good work just on the material from Safi. But they do mention how the assemblages or the plant assemblages from Safi and the temple of Tel Kasili are different.
Right.
And I thought, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Like,
and that's the part that killed me.
How so?
I don't wish to get on my soapbox.
Oh, please.
And start harping. But I say this like every other episode, like, how much stuff have we thrown out? Because we just weren't thinking. And I don't blame.
It's hot. You're in the middle of the day. It's hot. You can't think.
And again, all props to Sue Frumkin and all the paleoethnobotanists there who have this mind-numbing job of picking through microscopic plant remains and looking at them under, you know, big microscopes and stuff. But it never occurred to people really before to look at microscopic remains, and the amount of stuff that's been thrown out that could have been useful is astonishing. And that means that the baseline of comparative material that we have to contextualize this, and they talk about very properly, some stuff from Ebla and some stuff from Tel Kasili and a few other sites, temple sites.
They mention Ebla, they mention Ur. I don't know how. I mean,
they're too far afield.
The Ebla stuff is actually, it was actually done fairly recently,
right?
And there's some very good stuff there. There's like a pharmacy there, but just as a general proposition, should this be the kind of thing that everybody is doing as a matter of course in their excavations? And what does it mean for the process of excavation? Forget the pots. Look at the soil.
Right.
Right. That does
get done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm glad they brought up Kasili, because this is sort of the prime example of a Philistine temple. And they did say that the plant materials were different, but they also said that that both places, Safi and Kasili, had a lot of food storage and storage jars in the temple areas. So that was good to know. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk for a minute about
flax.
Flax.
There are a few flax.
I wanted to talk about chaste tree fruits.
Chaste tree.
Which I had never heard of before, and that might have been the only thing I looked up outside of the article. And what's really interesting is they were used in the cults of Artemis and Asclepius in Sparta, and in the cult of Hera, the temple of Hera on Samos. In terms of archaeology, I believe that this temple of Hera is the only place where chaste fruit is found besides Tel Asafi, besides Gat. So that, you know, I leads to the possibility, at least, that that these Philistines were worshiping a version of Hera. And besides that, the in modern times, we know that chaste tree fruit can be used. It contains, I didn't write this down properly, something similar to estrogen, and it's used to ease menstrual cramps. So the association with female fertility goddesses is,
yes, but it's also called the chaste tree,
right?
Because for men it has an aphrodisiac effect, or is alleged to have,
right?
So it is an anti-fertility,
right?
But hold thing. It in the second century BCE, it was referred to as medicinal and as an aphrodisiac.
Right.
Well,
it can also cause abortions. And in the second century sources and modern studies say don't take it when you're pregnant. So they knew what they were doing.
Well, I won't, but
clearly their paperwork was not all fully finalized. Also apparently a moth repellent.
Yeah, which, right.
which made me think, are they wearing wool? Do they need moth repellents because they're wearing wool?
It's very damp during the winter.
Why aren't they wearing flax, which there's some evidence of? So a lot of interesting things. Also, I guess some of this chaste tree was found in the Ulubaroon shipwreck.
Right.
So it's being traded.
Right. Which is also interesting. These all the plants that they found also, by the way, are native to the Mediterranean region
in
terms of distribution. Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot going on. And this is, I think, just the tip of the iceberg. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more research that's going to refine even this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very detailed study. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is the main takeaway these kinds of intercultural associations or inferences, like, the chaste tree is sacred to Hera and it's found in this temple at Telesaphi, so that suggests that they're the same people or connected in some way, and similar kinds of cults, or is that a kind of second order inference? And the real thing is, wow, we can really focus in on what it is that they were doing and their interaction with the environment and with the their very specific local practices.
Well, I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a big smorgasbord.
Yeah, yeah. I think.
Well, no, but look at what we've been talking about. We've spent a lot of time talking about Hera and intercultural relations.
Right, but we could be talking about trade and exchange, and we could be talking about sort of, because the chaste tree is circulating in the Eastern Mediterranean in the, in the late Bronze Age, we can be talking about, that elite style of the international style of the late Bronze Age, that it's part of that whole thing, right? And so I think there's just many different kinds of things that we could be talking about. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was, which we already raised a little bit, the poison darnel is known to be hallucinogenic. And we've already talked about, cannabis found at Arad.
Right.
So I think we need to, start thinking about cults in the Levant, in the Southern Levant or in Canaan, Israel, as being, far more extravagant in its mind-altering focus than before. And, we have lots of historic texts from Ugarit, from the Hebrew Bible, that we need to maybe reread in sort of less straight interpretations.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I think this is one thing that I liked about this article, sort of, Alex, the opposite of what you were saying, that they do the hard science and you can talk about the environment and you can talk about people interacting with the environment, but they're not afraid to do the speculation. I mean, all this business with Hera and everything is definitely right. speculative, right. but they're not afraid to include that in the article. They don't come down on it too hard, maybe in right. a sentence or two here and there, but basically they acknowledge it. And
right. Exactly. And I think that's important. Their tone. They hit the right tone.
It was the right tone.
Exactly. A lot of hard science, some crazy speculation, but they sort of acknowledge that and they contextualize it. And it made for just a really interesting, fun, enjoyable piece to read and to take from.
Yeah.
But Alex, what for you is the big takeaway? I mean, I think there's so many takeaways. I don't see a big one.
No, I don't think there's, I mean, I think the last comment is it. There's a kind of procedure that the authors go through. They do a lot of hard science based on incredibly detailed, tedious field work. And then they build a series of observations about the local and then make interesting, fun, judicious, but,
yeah,
you know, not extravagant, but judicious and exciting kinds of inferences about intercultural relations
yeah.
and similarities. And one of these, as you say, is the one of the real takeaways is how trippy the late Bronze Age in particular and the Iron Age specifically were for Mediterranean cults, because all these Mediterranean cults, and it seems like every other episode that we do
right.
is some kind of Mediterranean cult all the way across to Spain, and there these people are out of their heads,
right? And it's becoming such a constant theme.
Yeah, there's a real regularity to it.
Right. Exactly. Thank you. Perfect. Exactly. And it can't really be ignored as exotic or as, you know, as just a trippy thing. It's part of the culture and society.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've written, Alex, you've written about the role of alcohol in early complex society. And this seems like a natural part two. You know, the role of psychotropic drugs in the construction of religion or cult in the late Bronze Age, Iron Age. So
right.
Get to it.
What I don't know enough about is how these cults functioned at a social level, mm-hmm. you might say. Okay, so some people are definitely, you know, tripping balls, but
whoa,
what
can you say that on non-public radio?
But what does that mean, you know, for society at large, so to
right.
speak?
So two things on that. One is Telka Celi is really small, and
right.
it's a de novo, of which there are really just two de novo Philistine sites, and it's very oriented to the cult. So whatever's going on there is highly specialized, and it's a, you know, pretty reductive site.
Mm-hmm.
El Safi is a big, huge Philistine site.
Right.
Right. And we have continuity of cultic space in over roughly two centuries, plus or minus, in this one area. So whatever is going on there, I think one can extrapolate outwards that, you know, it's being viewed, participated, central to a large population at
right.
one of the major Philistine sites.
Yeah.
Well, and this also brings me to one of my other hobby horses.
Putting my hobby horses in public.
Yeah, my hobby horse is standing on a soapbox. And that is so much emphasis is placed on the big honking sites. And again,
wow.
relatively right. speaking, in our pokey little Southern Levantine terms, where these sites aren't even like homesteads in Mesopotamian terms.
Right.
But Like, what does a Philistine farmstead look like?
Well, it's that one site that our colleagues excavated. I forget the name of it. We have one.
Hey, one.
Right. Well, that's right.
Well, right. Yeah. One. I mean, yeah. We know, you know, a fair amount, I guess, about the Israelite rural aspect.
Yeah.
Right.
Rural villages.
So we know more about Philistine cities than
rural jurors.
Right.
Whatnot, but right. in other cultures, contemporary cultures, particularly the Philistines, but also, you know, Phoenicians and Arameans, there's a lot less that's known, mm-hmm. and I think that would be very interesting to see what's going on. There is a kind of urban so-called bias here, at work
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
Right. Though I think, again, because the Philistines, you know, they are.
Yeah, they had a Pentapolis. We know.
Right. They had a Pentapolis and they seem to hew to it pretty, pretty strictly. It seems to be a pretty urban culture.
Yeah. I
mean, the area in which they inhabit has been really not only thoroughly surveyed, but pretty thoroughly excavated.
Right. The border areas are more interesting. The border areas have places like Clairbit Sumilly, right?
The inner, outer, upper, lower.
Yeah, which is a village site, which has some Philistine.
It has a shrine.
Village site. It could be an administrative site, or it could be a post office site.
It's a Pony Express site.
Right. I'm just saying that border regions do contain smaller villages. And
but my feeling is that the whole Southern Levant is a border region.
Oh, that's true too.
Wherever you go, there's a border.
Yeah, that's true too.
I mean, you know, everyone talks about frontiers and borders. There are no frontiers. There are just borders because it's so compact. And there's so many different people. And there's so many different microenvironments. The whole place is a border. And when a political line shifts 5 to 10 kilometers,
mm-hmm.
you know, it creates a whole new set of
chaos.
Borders and contingencies and everything else.
But you could also say that about even highly urbanized places like Babylonia, really, because the nature of these things are homogeneous in the sense that we call it Babylonia. They speak Babylonian, but these places have all sorts of heterogeneous kinds of divisions in terms of certainly in terms of politics that
and
we know.
Right. But this leads into a much bigger topic. I don't really know if we have the time or inclination to go into it
in our third hour.
Because in Babylonia or Mesopotamia writ large, it's a highly literate society for so long that all of that heterogeneity has been regularized and homogenized.
Right. It looks heterogeneous.
Right. Into set pieces. Whereas the Southern Levant is just kind of a churning all the time.
Yeah. Right.
All these little groups churning, some writing, some not.
Right.
Some have distinctive cultures. Some have really boring material culture. And they're just constantly churning and sort of expanding, contracting. Whereas Mesopotamia is all sort of regularized.
But that's because the tradition, part of the tradition wants to make it seem that way. And part of the tradition makes it clear that, oh, there are all these different ethnic names. Oh, there are all these little boundary disputes. Oh, there are all these little contractual disputes. People are, you know, suing each other and beating each other up over land, over sheep.
But they have expansive mechanisms to deal with all those disputes.
Right. But, you know, it's a kind of churn. And we haven't even talked about Egypt and whatever churning goes on there.
Oh, there's less churning in Egypt. Egypt is pretty homogenized.
Well, that's what they want. That's what they want us to think.
But it is in that you have a 3,000-year political tradition and state that gets interrupted like three times, for a century, and then gets reconstituted.
This is a different podcast.
Well, you see, this is how you can go from a little seed of the Chase tree
From small acorns grow mighty oaks.
Right. Grow mighty, mighty inferences and speculations. Well, final thoughts then?
Oh, I'm exhausted. I've exhausted my final thoughts.
That's the baseline.
I don't know. I'll reiterate that this was just a really interesting read, combining the hard science with the somewhat crazy speculation.
Exemplary.
The way that worked.
Yeah.
It's an example.
It's a fine example.
It's a fine example.
All right.
Yeah, no, I, you know, just don't throw any dirt away.
Right. Save it all.
Save all the dirt. And I haven't even gotten my hobby horse on its thing to talk about soil genomics.
Yeah.
Where you could drill down even further to the DNA level.
Right.
And well, all right. So that would be our fourth hour.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think we're all exhausted now. Okay.
I'm going to turn off.
We need to thank our guest.
Oh yes. Thanks. Matt.
Thanks to Matt for your.
Thanks for stopping by.
Experiences in Nineveh.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure and an honor appearing on this podcast.
Well, it was really interesting.
Pleasure was all ours, and you know, stay out of nasty places. Out of rat holes in particular.
I will try.
Stay out of tunnels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless there's a winged bull, and then I'll go down.
Okay.
All right.
Well, all I can say is after this episode, I really am rushing out to the garden store to look for a chaste tree. But in any case, as always, we'd like to thank our music director, the artist still known as Erez Dessel, for our theme music. Look for his performances in the Chicago area and beyond. Why not follow him on Instagram at 54BPM? We'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Tandy Corporation, a subsidiary of Yoyodyne Propulsion Systems. Remember, Tandy's TRS-80 is the most powerful pocket computer you can buy. And so, to get in touch, leave us a comment right here, or hit the little heart-shaped button, because hearts mean love. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at ThisAncient, and on Facebook. Contact us via email at thisweekintheancientneareast, it's all one rushed word, as you know, at gmail.com, or send us a postcard at P.O. Box 1177, Boston, Mass. 02134.